From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. And I'm David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. Now, here are the issues. Donald Trump named John Bolton as National Security Advisor, bringing a fierce critic of diplomacy with Iran and North Korea into his inner circle. Fears of a trade war buffeted markets after Mr. Trump announced planned tariffs against China. Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg apologized for a breach of trust after a political campaign strategist's accessed 50 million people's data without their knowledge. Allies and members of Congress were startled by Donald Trump's call to congratulate Vladimir Putin for his re-election as president of Russia without mentioning Russian election meddling. And hirings and firings brought fresh turmoil to the legal team defending the president during the special counsel's investigation into Russian interference in American politics. So it's another insanely busy week. And I guess the thing that is going to be causing late-night burning of the oil in embassies around Washington as ambassadors craft kind of emergency telegrams back home, Dan Raviv, is the appointment of a new National Security Advisor. Now, all National Security Advisors are important, but John Bolton isn't just any foreign policy guy. Tell us why, if you're a foreign ambassador writing a memo home, you might give some special thought to explaining what this appointment means.
I think I'd have to write to my government about John Bolton, the TV analyst. He's been on the Fox News Channel for years now, after 11 years ago serving as the U.S. ambassador at the United Nations, and he had a State Department job. But basically, he's been a commentator. He gives speeches. And that means that he's made money by saying provocative things. That doesn't mean that in the White House, working for the president as his chief advisor on national security, meaning on various world trouble spots, that he's going to be just that way. It's a bit of a mystery. So if I were writing a report, I'd say the John Bolton question. Will he be the same Bolton who we've been hearing on TV, who has advocated military action against North Korea and Iran to stop their nuclear programs? And it seems like he's not in favor of President Trump meeting, as is planned, with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. These could be some sharp turns in U.S. policy if he says that to the president and Mr. Trump listens.
So, Linda, Dan has set up very well some of the areas where Donald Trump might be influenced by John Bolton, because, you know, they think alike in some ways about, you know, I guess they share a view that it's better to be feared than to try to be loved, that, you know, an iron fist is often quite effective. But just before we get to that, which is really important, let's look at why it's, in some ways, you could be surprised that John Bolton is a good fit, because they don't agree on some quite important things.
Right, exactly. No, John Bolton wants more punitive sanctions against Russia. He thinks Putin is a bad actor, and Donald Trump, we know, is very solicitous toward Vladimir Putin, and that will be a very interesting dynamic. I mean, John Bolton says that he will defer to Donald Trump. He understands that Donald Trump is president, but he's a well-known neocon, hardliner, and whether he can get Donald Trump to get off his pro-Putin jag will be fascinating to watch.
And what about the Iraq War? They, in theory at least, they disagree quite strongly about
Absolutely.
The Iraq War of 2003.
Yeah, Bolton was an architect of the Iraq War. He was in the Bush administration, and Donald Trump called that a massive mistake. So there's another clash. Now, that war has already taken place, so that's history. But, you know, Donald Trump campaigned on America first and not getting involved in massive, expensive foreign adventures. And now he has hired a guy who it appears might be heading us into massive foreign adventures.
But I imagine there'll be more debates now in the Oval Office. And assuming that retired General James Mattis keeps his job.
The Defense Secretary.
Yes. Right. And if he keeps his job at the Pentagon, well, Mattis is known to be a man who has read a lot of history, right, very intelligent, and reluctant to go to war. And I think that President Trump apparently enjoys having people argue before him. And then, of course, President Trump using apparently his gut instinct will decide. And so again, Donald Trump has set up that kind of Oval Office debate.
But Mattis is at the Pentagon, and John Bolton will be at his side at the White House. And we know that Donald Trump often reflects the views of the last person he's listened to.
There's also, isn't there, when you talk to people who've watched how Donald Trump interacts with his inner circle, particularly in national security, there's a sense that, although, as you say, Dan, he himself boasts that he likes drama, he likes conflict, he absolutely hates the idea that some expert is lecturing him in a way that implies that he's kind of ignorant. And that was, in some senses, what doomed his previous national security advisor.
General McMaster may have lectured the president in that way. Yeah.
Now, of course, the danger there is that you end up with a situation where people think, well, then I'm going to tell this guy what he wants to hear, and I'm going to flatter him. I'm not going to actually challenge him with kind of complex information. Do you think that John Bolton's record in government, as you say before, he was in government before, was as a kind of teller of complex, harsh truths to power, or was he more of a kind of a guy with an agenda?
Well, more than a decade ago, I'd say a guy with an agenda. It looks that way now, but again, a lot of this was bluster as a TV analyst. I don't know if he'll become more cautious with a government job again.
That's a useful corrective that we don't know yet what he will be like in office. And I think in some ways Donald Trump is a showman and he has hired a kind of TV war hawk to be his security advisor. And yeah, you're right, this could be part of the show as well. Linda, we do know one thing that is going to happen, which is there is going to be a trade confrontation with China and a whole bunch of other countries because Donald Trump is launching two separate, pretty substantial, at least symbolic, attacks on foreign trade. He's imposing tariffs on aluminium and steel, but now he's also using a section of trade law that allows you to accuse China of essentially stealing American secrets and high tech, and that costing America so much money and American businesses so much money that America is going to slap tariffs on billions of dollars, potentially, of Chinese imports. How has China reacted, and are we heading into a trade war?
It sure feels that way. China immediately announced that it would impose tariffs on $3 billion worth of American-produced goods, including wine, nuts, pork. That's not a lot, but I suspect more will come. We're already seeing on television farmers are freaking out in America because American farm exports are critical. And the interesting domestic political aspect of that is that farmers tend to support Donald Trump. Donald Trump won the rural vote, and he is taking actions that look quite damaging to them.
Now, that's very interesting, because Donald Trump talks a lot about, Dan Raviv, he talks a lot about how a country isn't a country without steel, and he's going to protect the steel jobs, and he's going to, you know, he remembers the kind of Rust Belt states where you used to have big steel mills and coal mines and kind of big, tough, manly things like that. And he's going to protect those with these tariffs, and that's his definition of what makes a country great. But as Linda says, farming is part of the American kind of story. It's part of the American myth. It's also politically very potent. Why would farming come up in a trade war with China? Does America sell a bunch of farm goods to China?
Oh, soybeans come up all the time, as well as farming equipment, so to China and to other nations. And so there's concern a trade war would hurt U.S. exports. Just when President Trump wants to help U.S. exports, well, a trade war stops a lot of exports and imports. Beyond that, consumers in the United States in general would face higher prices. Just think about it this way. Americans like buying cheap goods that are made in countries like China, others typically in Asia with lower wages, and the Trump administration might block some of those goods and insist, in effect, that we buy goods made in America. They'll be more expensive. You'd have a rebellion by some of the Trump voters in states where people voted for him, and now will say, what'd you do? You raised our prices? And so I think President Trump has had to actually weigh what's more important to him, defending, as you say, the steel industry and similar industries, or consumer prices. He may change his mind on what he's doing.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I actually asked Donald Trump once when I interviewed him, I think back in 2016, and I interviewed him in Trump Tower back then during the campaign, and I literally said to him, you know, you're talking about putting tariffs on Chinese goods. At that stage, it was 30-40% tariffs. And I said, a lot of your guys, they buy stuff at Walmart and it's made in China and it's going to be 30-40% more expensive. So what are you going to say to them? And his answer kind of really didn't want to acknowledge that there was a trade-off. His answer was, oh, you know, my guys, maybe at the moment they buy like 4 dolls for their daughter. Maybe they're going to buy 1 doll for their daughter. But they'll be happy because they'll have a great job.
Don't be surprised if he says that now as president, too. He is remarkably consistent in what his gut instincts have been. Right. And he may still feel that way.
Linda, there's one more thing that worries American business a lot when they look at their massive operations in China. And remember, of course, China is one of the most important markets for companies like Apple. It's not just a cheap place to get an iPhone made. It's also a place where a vast middle class buys a lot of iPhones. They're very concerned that the Chinese are masters at things that aren't tariffs, that aren't a officially a trade war, but they can make life absolutely miserable inside China for American businesses. Do you expect business leaders are going to be bending Donald Trump's ear and telling him to watch out for that stuff?
Absolutely. I think business leaders feel that Donald Trump fundamentally doesn't understand trade. He doesn't need to go to school and take a class in trade theory, but he just needs to understand that the rules of economics, it's really math, that just because we have a trade deficit with China doesn't mean that they're winning and we're losing. With free trade, all boats rise. We pay lower prices and we get to produce items overseas at a cheaper rate, and everybody wins.
Now, Linda, you know what the president says, that he's in favor of free trade if it's fair trade. And he says that China especially does have various hidden taxes and restrictions on U.S. products. So he says reciprocal action. That was his big word, reciprocal, and says the U.S. should be just as hard as China has been.
And Dan, you raise an interesting point, which is that China absolutely does cheat. And the president is right and is not the first president to get very angry about the Chinese stealing American high technology. Barack Obama did, George W. Bush did, Bill Clinton did, because that's what China does. But can you make a case that some of the other trade actions he's taking, picking fights with other countries about their aluminium and steel, that's not necessarily a great way to build a coalition against Chinese cheating? Is that something he's hearing?
He's not a coalition builder, and that was clear from the very beginning. He became president in January of last year, and almost right away he pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. A dozen countries were going to stand together as a trade bloc against China, including Canada and Mexico, our nearest important neighbors. The U.S. pulled out. The TPP is going on without us, but he's decided on just having one-on-one agreements, and it could be a very rocky ride.
Just before we head into the break, let's just tee up the fact that one of the world's most famous digital companies, kind of iconic business, Facebook, it's in a lot of trouble. And Mark Zuckerberg, its founder, who doesn't give a lot of interviews, he's been out giving interviews all week. Linda, is he fighting tough or is he sounding apologetic this week?
He's being very apologetic. Mark Zuckerberg is probably not the best spokesman for Facebook. If you watched his comments, he just didn't have the right affect. He said the right words, but he somehow didn't seem convincing. And so they had to send out Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer, who repeated his message that we're terribly sorry. We respect people's privacy. We want to be regulated. That was astounding, hearing a company demand regulation. And they're also willing to testify before Congress. It feels like they're pleading for their lives, although I don't expect Facebook to go away.
Well, more of Issues in the News in just a moment. And this program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Here's a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. And now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. And I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Dan, we were talking about Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, big, big bosses of Facebook, going on TV to say they were very sorry for what they called a breach of trust. What was the breach of trust?
Specifically, a company called Cambridge Analytics. It's in Britain, right, David?
That's right.
Right, and they were helping the Trump campaign, putting together the data that you need these days to win an election. And a lot of the data was harvested from Facebook. And it turns out that Facebook is not just a place where you innocently post your messages to your friends and your photos of what you had for dinner last night and where you traveled, but companies and political campaigns can actually take that data. Supposedly, it'll be anonymous. It won't be about you by name, but it could be. Everything's there. You've given your name, where you are, what you buy, what you like. And you can imagine what that information is worth. And Facebook, frankly, has made a ton of money on data that we, all around the world, voluntarily put there. And so Cambridge Analytics used it to an extent that Facebook says it never, ever intended and won't let companies do again. How will they stop it? Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, said, we'll identify any apps that are using our data and we'll publicize that fact, so you'll know and you'll be able to turn off some parts of your account. Well, it's a thought. They have to somehow restore faith that they're not selling all of our data and personal information.
And Linda, how does this tie into things like the 2016 election and the Trump campaign? What's the link with Cambridge Analytica?
Well, Cambridge Analytica was hired by the Trump campaign, so they're part of a British company called SCL. Cambridge Analytica has an office in San Antonio, Texas. This is where the Trump data operations took place. So it's not known if there's a direct link between this massive breach of Facebook data and the Trump campaign and the Russians. We can't forget about the Russians here. But it's all in the same soup, and that is part of what makes this entire issue so inflammatory.
And can we expect to see people like Mark Zuckerberg hauled before Congress and being forced to testify?
I think so. I mean, he's volunteered to testify. He knows he's in big trouble. This is the biggest crisis the company has faced since it was started. The fact of the matter is that this data breach took place in 2015, and they knew about it. This has all been hidden in plain sight for years. And the fact that they took so long to address it and say, oops, sorry, is shocking.
And Dan, if we've just finally, for several years now, we've had a bit of a kind of transatlantic divide where Europeans were much more likely to say that big tech companies like Facebook, but some of the others, Google, that they were getting too big, too intrusive, that they were not really careful enough about people's privacy, and that it was time to start really regulating, using the power of government to pass laws that protected consumers and to regulate them more like airlines or power companies, like utilities. In America, people were much warier of that and thought these are just great big corporate successes, you know, it's entrepreneurship, we don't go down that route of regulation. Is that changing? Do you think America might be now more open to actually having a discussion about whether a new form of industry has emerged, which is so large and so powerful that maybe it needs regulation?
Yes, I do. I think privacy concerns are up. There are red flags all over, but there's a different trend also at work here in Washington, the Trump administration being against regulation and being proud of the fact that many of the regulations on lots of industries have been eliminated. So I'm not sure what direction they might go. A lot of this will be up to Congress. I agree there will be hearings. I think it's up to individuals, and that'll be the general view of the majority party here, the Republicans. Mm-hmm. It's up to every family and every individual. If you don't want to share your data, if you're concerned about privacy, then don't put it online. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure we'll get government regulation.
And of course, Linda, this could become another transatlantic point of tension because Europeans aren't going to sit still. They could start regulating Facebook in Europe.
Absolutely.
And then you're going to potentially see another kind of conflict.
That's right. I mean, Americans think of Facebook as an American place, but it's a global place. I mean, they're up to, what, 2 billion users.
It's almost a country on its own.
It is. Exactly. I guess it's bigger than any country. And I actually liked The Economist had in their latest issue has a suggestion that Facebook create an industry ombudsman so that would effectively self-regulate. I think this is what a lot of industries want to do, this before the government comes in and really messes things up, that they realize they have a problem, get ahead of the problem, and do it themselves.
And in the U.S., that may work. But in Europe, I agree with you, David. I think the European Union will continue to be tough on that industry.
Yes.
Precisely because in Europe, it's easy to make the case that these evil American companies, that plays into it. It feels like every week we don't always have to talk about Donald Trump and Russia, but we have to talk about Donald Trump and Russia. So we had a big election in Russia. It wasn't a nail biter, but it was important. It was Vladimir Putin's predictable re-election as president of Russia. And it's pretty normal for an American president to pick up the phone and say, I gather you just got elected to a big, important job. And, you know, they say some form of congratulations. And Barack Obama has, in his day, congratulated Vladimir Putin for getting re-elected. So it's not unprecedented that Donald Trump did that this week. But, Dan, there was something about that call that did raise eyebrows.
It leaked out, and it certainly is not denied by the White House, that President Trump was advised by at least one advisor in all capital letters on a sheet of paper, do not congratulate, because Putin's election was seen as somewhat fraudulent. And of course, the nature of what Putin's been doing, do not congratulate. But the first thing that President Trump did was congratulate Putin, and President Trump said so. And so Mr. Trump actually explained it on Twitter, saying good relations with Russia would be a good thing, not a bad thing. Russia can be helpful on a lot of the world's trouble spots. He's standing by that, and it's the basic explanation as to why he refuses to criticize Putin about, well, anything, whereas other administration officials are pretty often critical of Russia. Mr. Trump says we need great relations with Moscow. I think that maybe at play is the old Henry Kissinger idea from the Nixon administration in the 70s of playing off Russia and China. There's signs of that going on. Donald Trump has no experience at playing the game, but note that at age 94, Henry Kissinger has, from time to time, visited the Oval Office and has advised Mr. Trump.
That's certainly one explanation. And during the election campaign, we saw Donald Trump suggesting, as you say, that Vladimir Putin could be tremendously helpful with things like the fight against Islamic State and the fight in Syria. There were other foreign policy types who said that was not borne out by anything Russia was doing on the ground in Syria. But let's turn, Linda, to some of the other criticisms that not just Democrats, but also some Republican members of Congress and some foreign governments made about some of the things they had hoped that Donald Trump would raise with Vladimir Putin during this phone call, given that in some senses, when an American president makes that kind of a call, he's not just representing his own views or his own government, but the free world in that kind of old phrase. What were some of the things that they wanted the leader of the free world to raise with Vladimir Putin that Donald Trump did not?
I'd say the biggest omission is he didn't bring up meddling in the election. I mean, the Russians meddled in the American elections in 2016. They've meddled in European elections, and they're meddling now. They're meddling today. They're going to meddle in our midterm elections in the fall. This is known. This is documented. And they want Donald Trump to come up with an action plan on this and to be a leader. And he is, yes, having a decent working relationship with Vladimir Putin is a good thing, but there has to be sort of a carrot and a stick. He's all carrot and no stick.
And I don't want to sound like the Brit demanding everyone think about Britain, but it's certainly the case that in my own home country, Britain, people were hoping that he would raise the fact that the British government is accusing Vladimir Putin's intelligence services of using an incredibly dangerous nerve agent to launch an attempted assassination in the streets of England against a former KGB agent.
No, I mean, there were people making arguments that this was a violation of Article 5 of NATO, that this was an attack on one is an attack on all, and that it really did behoove Donald Trump to say something to Putin, which he did not. And so this is one of the big abiding questions hanging over the Trump presidency, which is why is he so solicitous toward Vladimir Putin? What does Putin have on him, possibly? I mean, there's a lot of speculation. We just don't know, and I'm dying to find out.
Dan Raviv, is there also, just finally, a sense that Donald Trump's own administration is not in complete lockstep on Russia and election meddling? Because you have, last week, the Treasury imposed sanctions on a bunch of Russians because the special counsel, Robert Mueller, had indicted those same Russians and said that he had hard and fast evidence of them interfering the 2016 election to the level of paying unwitting Americans to dress as Hillary Clinton in a prison jumpsuit and ride around in a cage pretending that she was in jail, and a whole bunch of extraordinary stuff that did also break American law. So you had Donald Trump's Treasury sanctioning Russians for election meddling. And yet, Linda is right that the one person in the entire government who is not willing to call out Vladimir Putin for this is Donald Trump. What gives?
The administration's not been acting in lockstep, as you say, but it's the president who definitely sets the tone. It is up to the president. And keep in mind, he's shaking up his administration, having very recently fired the Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and another hardliner who's been CIA director, former Congressman Mike Pompeo, is the nominee for Secretary of State. Look for the Senate confirmation hearings. The questions and answers should be fascinating. Of course, as we've reported here, John Bolton will be the National Security Advisor. So there'll be new voices on these subjects. Another possible change, though I don't expect the president to change, on, as you said, policies that are very positive toward Vladimir Putin.
And while we're talking about hirings and firings, let's end by just looking briefly at the president's legal team, because these are the times we live in that we also need a segment on the president's legal team. His administration is being investigated for whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia in that election meddling in 2016 by the special counsel Robert Mueller. As you would expect, the president has hired a bunch of high-priced lawyers. That's not been a very stable team this last few days.
Right. So amidst all the hirings and firings of the week, John Dowd, a member of Trump's legal team, he was fired. And he brought in a well-known lawyer named Joe DeGeneva, who is another TV commentator who is famous for floating conspiracy theories that the FBI was out to get Trump. John Dowd wasn't necessarily the best lawyer in the city. I mean, he had tweeted some things that were unfortunate and made matters worse for Trump. But this situation is just getting out of control a little bit, and having a conspiracy theorist in his midst doesn't help.
Dan, last question. Apparently, one of the big disputes between the lawyers and the president is whether the president should sit down for a face-to-face interview with Robert Mueller. Mueller, if you were his lawyer, would you tell him to do that?
Yeah, John Dowd was telling the president, be very cautious, don't agree to it. But President Trump said, I do want to testify to the special prosecutor. I think he has to. I think that President Trump believes that he can put many of these doubts to rest, and I think he really does want to. I don't know whether it'll be videotaped and whether we'll ever see the video. My bet is yes. David?
Well, that's all the time we have, and that will be his greatest rating success ever, perhaps. Thanks to Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News, and to Linda Feldman, Washington bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program is produced by Carol Castiel and VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.